Think of the global shipping lanes. Not as lines on a map, but, you know, as this massive, tightly synchronized industrial conveyor belt.
Right, it's a fragile belt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you jam a wrench into the gears at one end, say down at the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the belt doesn't just like stop there. The gears grind, the tension builds, and eventually the whole system snaps.
And that means halting production in European factories or jacking up prices at American gas stations.
Yeah, and right now we are looking at a scenario where multiple wrenches are being thrown into the most critical gears of that global conveyor belt all at the exact same time.
It's pretty alarming, especially when you look at the raw
It
data.
really is. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we are opening up a really fascinating stack of intelligence and battlefield assessments from the Institute for the Study of War, the Eurasia Daily Monitor, the War Zone, and the Jamestown Foundation.
A lot of heavy reading this week.
Well, for sure. But our mission for you today is to explore how asymmetric warfare, specifically this totally unprecedented battle for control of the seas, is violently colliding with these deep, hidden internal power struggles within authoritarian regimes.
Yeah, the contrast between the overt chaos on the open water and the secretive paranoia behind closed doors is staggering when you really dig into these reports.
Definitely. In this deep dive, we're going to cover how the global shipping industry is facing dual choke points, how literal golf carts are replacing main battle tanks in Europe, and why a massive scandalous corruption case involving power for sex in China actually reveals a profound structural weakness in Xi Jinping's absolute rule.
There's a lot to get through.
There is. So let's start with those global shipping arteries, because the escalation we are seeing in the Middle East is, well, it's rapidly weaponizing the most vulnerable points of global trade.
Yeah, we are seeing an escalating U.S.-Iran conflict essentially turn the oceans into a hostage situation.
Right, because the Houthis in Yemen have just declared an immediate maritime embargo on Saudi oil shipments passing through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
And they aren't being subtle about it. They're calling it an eye for an eye, actively ordering commercial vessels to turn back or face destruction.
Which is terrifying for the crews. And this is happening simultaneously with Iran coercing vessels on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula, right?
Right.
Over in the Strait of Hormuz.
Exactly. And they haven't just been making threats. They have been conducting direct strikes on Malta-flagged and Liberian-flagged tankers.
Okay, so we are looking at dual closures. The Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait are both being choked off. I mean, it's like trying to pinch off both the carotid arteries of global energy at the same time.
That's a very accurate way to put it. It's a sum of all fears scenario for the markets because it cuts off safe passage out of the region entirely.
And it's happening against the backdrop of a drastically escalating regional war. Looking at these assessments, the scope of the retaliation is just huge. Like, Iran attacked a U.S. base at Muwaffaq Salty Air Base in Jordan, which tragically killed two U.S. service members.
And the U.S. response to that has been severe. We just saw the conclusion of an eighth consecutive night of strikes.
8 nights in a row.
Yeah. The U.S. is systematically hitting Iranian coastal surveillance and drone storage facilities, basically trying to blind their maritime strike capabilities.
But wait, looking at the targeting list here, the U.S. also struck the Darkova nuclear power plant. But the IAEA notes that this plant is in its very early construction stages. So why launch a massive strike against what is basically a construction site?
Well, because it's about signaling. By hitting Darkovan, the U.S. is demonstrating that Iran's most prized long-term strategic assets are completely vulnerable and within reach, even if they aren't fully operational yet.
Oh, I see. It's a warning about future capabilities.
Right. And the infrastructure targeting is becoming entirely reciprocal now. Iran has expanded its own strikes away from just military targets hitting energy and telecom infrastructure.
Yeah, the reports say they've hit Quadi power and desalination plants. They even struck a Barony data center belonging to Patelco. And here's where it gets really interesting. Our sources note Iran is reportedly utilizing maneuverable re-entry vehicles to improve their ballistic missile accuracy against these U.S. bases.
Which is a critical technological leap.
A MARVI, right?
Yeah, a maneuverable re-entry vehicle, or a MARVI. It means the missile isn't just following a predictable parabolic arc like a thrown football.
Okay.
As it comes back down into the atmosphere, it can actively adjust its trajectory. It literally steers mid-air to evade air defense systems and hit specific coordinates.
Wow. And they aren't doing this in a vacuum. The reports show they are receiving satellite targeting assistance from Russia and China to guide these MARVEs. I mean, it is a highly coordinated effort to apply pressure on the U.S. and its allies.
It's an unprecedented level of technological collaboration between these autocratic states to challenge U.S. hegemony in the region.
But hold on, I need to push back here because this doesn't make logical sense to me. If Iran is already suffering economically and they are facing a renewed U.S. naval blockade on their own ports, attacking Saudi, Kuwaiti, and Bahraini infrastructure seems like a suicidal way to invite a wider war they absolutely cannot afford to fight.
You'd think so, right?
Yeah. Why push all their chips into the middle of the table right now?
What's fascinating here is the underlying strategic logic. Iran's goal is not to win a conventional ship-to-ship war of attrition against the United States Navy.
Because they know they can't.
Exactly. Their goal is cost imposition. They want to create so much economic pain, so much logistical chaos in the global insurance markets and fuel supply chains that the U.S. and its allies are forced to retreat or de-escalate on Iran's terms.
Just to get the global conveyor belt moving again.
Precisely. They are betting that Western democracies have a lower tolerance for economic pain than Iran has for military strikes.
That is a dangerous bet.
It is. And furthermore, we have to look at the Houthis' agency in this. The Houthis might be using this Red Sea embargo specifically to deter Saudi Arabia from conducting further strikes on the Sana'a airport in Yemen.
So they have their own local motives.
Right. While the Houthis are armed by Iran, they have their own distinct survival objectives. It perfectly highlights how proxy groups have overlapping but distinct regional agendas.
So it's basically a massive game of chicken with the global economy.
But, you know, while Iran and the Houthis are attempting to use these asymmetric tactics to choke off a superpower, Ukraine is currently executing an absolute masterclass in this exact strategy against Russia in the Black Sea.
Oh, absolutely. The contrast in execution between the two theaters is remarkable.
It really is. Let's look at the sheer scale of the numbers from the Institute for the Study of War and the War Zone. Ukraine has launched a massive coordinated drone campaign, striking 176 Russian vessels in the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov in just 13 days. Just think about that operational tempo for a second. Hitting 176 vessels in less than 2 weeks requires an astonishing level of intelligence, targeting, and sustained drone production.
And they aren't just hitting random patrol boats either. They systematically destroyed 5 vital Russian ferries. The sources actually name them specifically: the Lavrenti, Pangea, Isk, Maria, and the SKS-1.
And those aren't small targets.
No. Taking out those 5 ferries degraded the Kerch ferry crossing's capacity by a staggering 75%, and it crippled 80% of military transport to occupied Crimea.
We need to unpack why ferries are the ultimate Achilles heel for a modern mechanized army.
Please do.
You cannot easily transport an entire battalion of 40-ton main battle tanks or massive fuel silos over standard highways or pontoon bridges. You need heavy maritime transport.
Right.
So when Ukraine destroys those specific high-capacity ferries, they aren't just sinking ships. They are amputating Russia's ability to move heavy armor and sustain their forces on the peninsula.
And the downstream effects of amputating that supply line are immediate. It has caused a massive fuel and power crisis in Crimea. The situation is so dire that Russia is having to prioritize power exclusively for hospitals.
Yeah, general illumination across the peninsula has dropped fivefold compared to normal levels.
It's forcing Russia into a virtual naval retreat.
Yep. For the first time since 2013, Russia has 0 ships operating in the Mediterranean.
Wow, 0 ships. Because they were pulling everything back just to survive the drone swarms, our sources say they're even having to pull 200 elite drone crews away from the active front lines on land just to try and protect their remaining naval ships in the harbor.
Which is mind-boggling because it's fundamentally dictating the reality on the ground.
Right. The Russian Ministry of Defense is actually abandoning fast-paced, mechanized tank maneuver warfare. Instead, they are prioritizing small, motorized vehicles like buggies, ATVs, motorcycles, literal golf carts for slow positional warfare in what are essentially kill zones.
It represents a total devolution of military doctrine.
It really does. Mm-hmm. If I can use an analogy here, watching Ukraine's naval strategy, especially since they're operating without a traditional navy of their own, is like watching a lightweight MMA fighter systematically destroying a heavyweight's knees and joints with precise low kicks.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah. Eventually, the giant simply can't stand up to throw a punch, no matter how much power they have in their arms. But I still struggle to wrap my head around this. Are we really seeing a supposed military superpower, give up on tank charges, and settle for sending guys on ATVs and motorcycles into modern combat against artillery?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the answer is yes, because their logistics are fractured. Those ATVs and buggies are a symptom of a supply chain that can no longer support heavy, mechanized maneuver warfare.
I see.
Look at Ukraine's continuous strikes on the M14 Rostov-Crimea highway.
Well, Russian officials keep claiming that highway is secure, though.
They do, but the constant drone strikes prove otherwise. And this proves a fundamental rule of modern warfare: controlling land means absolutely nothing if you cannot protect the supply lines running across it.
Right, if you can't feed the beast.
Exactly. If you can't move fuel, ammo, and heavy armor safely because your ferries are sunk and your highways are targeted, you are reduced to moving small groups of men on motorcycles and golf carts, hoping they can slip through the kill zones. It's a war of attrition dictated by broken logistics.
It is just a stunning shift in how we understand power projection. But, you know, military failures don't just happen in a vacuum on the battlefield. When an asymmetric strategy successfully breaks down a superpower's military logistics externally, it inevitably triggers paranoia, blame, and power vacuums internally.
Yes, it certainly does.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the internal dynamics rocking the leadership in both Iran and China right now are just as volatile as the battlefields.
Waging these prolonged, grinding conflicts puts immense, crushing pressure on the internal stability of authoritarian regimes.
So let's start with Iran. The supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, is reportedly incapacitated or seriously wounded.
Which is a huge deal.
Huge. And this isn't just a rumor circulating on social media. The foreign minister himself, Abbas Araghchi, publicly admitted that a secret six-person committee within the Supreme National Security Council is currently making on-the-spot decisions without Mojtaba's direct input.
It is a functional power vacuum at the very top of a state that relies on absolute, centralized religious and political authority.
And into that vacuum steps factional chaos. We are seeing hardliners like Vahidi totally overruling the pragmatists. That internal power struggle has caused the total collapse of any negotiations with the U.S.
The whole system just seizes up.
Exactly. But then you pivot over to China, and it looks like the exact opposite scenario. Xi Jinping isn't missing. He is actively purging his highest ranks.
The contrast in how autocracies handle pressure is really revealing.
Totally. Our sources from the Jamestown Foundation detail how Xi Jinping just expelled a sitting Politburo member, Ma Xinrui. Ma is a former aerospace expert and the former Xinjiang Party secretary. I mean, a major player.
The very prominent figure.
And he was expelled entirely on corruption charges. We're talking accepting huge bribes, engaging in power for sex transactions, and large-scale family corruption.
But there is a crucial detail here that breaks from the established playbook of the last few years.
Right. Unlike every other top-level purge under Xi Jinping recently, like the purges of generals Zhang Yuxia or He Weidong Ma, was not charged with political disloyalty.
Which is very telling.
He wasn't accused of factionalism or treason against the party, just corruption. But wait. In a dictatorship, doesn't accusing someone in your inner circle of treason or political disloyalty make the leader look more powerful? Doesn't it send a terrifying message to everyone else? Why would Xi Jinping just use run-of-the-mill corruption charges for a guy sitting in the powerful Politburo?
This raises an important question about the mechanics of absolute power. What you're pointing out is actually an insoluble paradox for Xi Jinping.
Okay, how so?
Think about how much power he has consolidated over the last decade. His inner circle now consists entirely of people he personally handpicked and promoted.
Right. There are no rival factions left. They are all his guys.
Exactly. So if he suddenly charges his own handpicked loyalists with political treason or forming dangerous factions against him, it makes his own judgment look incredibly flawed.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. It implies to the rest of the party and the public that his political screening process failed and that he routinely elevates treacherous officials to the highest ranks of government. That damages his prestige and his aura of infallibility.
So if absolute loyalty is a prerequisite for the job, you can't fire them for disloyalty without admitting you made a mistake.
Precisely. By using ordinary corruption instead of political treason, it lowers the threshold for him to purge rivals, scapegoats, or underperformers.
Because everyone expects a little corruption anyway.
Exactly. He doesn't have to prove a grand political conspiracy. He just has to point to a bribery scandal. It's a way to clean house without admitting any political vulnerability.
So ordinary graft becomes the ultimate quiet weapon for elite infighting. You don't have to prove they are a traitor to the state, just that their family member got a sweetheart real estate deal, or, you know, point to a power for sex scandal. And because corruption is often systemic in these structures, that makes everyone vulnerable all the time.
It ensures total compliance through universal vulnerability. If everyone has a little dirt on them, the leader can selectively enforce corruption laws to remove anyone at any time for any reason while still looking like a champion of justice.
It's a brilliant but deeply paranoid system. So what does this all mean for the rest of the world? We have authoritarian regimes dealing with deep internal paranoia, secret committees, and purges.
Right.
But externally, they were still collaborating.
Very much so.
As we noted with the Marhis earlier, China and Russia are actively aiding Iran's targeting capabilities.
Mm.
While autocracies scramble internally, how are neighboring democracies reacting to this coordinated asymmetric threat?
Well, they are waking up from decades of complacency, and they are restructuring their entire approach to national security.
Japan's moves in these assessments are truly historic. They are currently developing their first centralized intelligence agency since World War II.
That's a massive shift.
Think about the gravity of that for a nation with a strictly pacifist constitution. They are actively consulting the United States, Germany, and Australia for advice on technology, staffing, cyber defense, and counterintelligence.
And they are recognizing that the threat isn't just military, right? It's economic.
Yes, because Japan is also creating a foreign investment screening body. It's modeled directly off to the U.S. program CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Basically, they are setting up a financial firewall to lock out hostile capital and stop foreign investments that pose national security risks to their tech and infrastructure.
It is a holistic approach to defense. It's acknowledging that in modern asymmetric warfare, buying a strategic port or a telecom company is just as dangerous as parking a warship off the coast.
It's like a homeowner who for decades just assumed a locked front door was enough to keep the neighborhood safe. But after watching the houses down the street get targeted in highly sophisticated ways, they are finally installing a comprehensive, high-tech, multi-layered home security system with cameras and motion sensors.
Great analogy.
But I have to ask, doesn't this aggressive historic move by Japan risk provoking China even further? We've already seen the PRC aggressively claiming the Philippines' northern Batanes Islands. They are actively arresting Taiwanese nationals on espionage charges. By militarizing their intelligence and aggressively blocking Chinese investment, isn't Japan just throwing gasoline on the fire in the Indo-Pacific?
It's a common concern, you know, the fear of provocation. But if we analyze the strategic outcomes over the last few years, this actually demonstrates the complete failure of the PRC's pressure campaign.
Yeah.
Beijing's goal with its aggression in the South China Sea, around Taiwan, and against the Philippines was to intimidate its neighbors into submission. They wanted to force them to decouple from the United States out of fear.
But it did the exact opposite.
Exactly. Instead of intimidating Tokyo, this aggression successfully pushed Japan to abandon decades of pacifist inertia. It catalyzed them to modernize their security architecture and integrate deeply into a U.S.-aligned Indo-Pacific coalition.
So it backfired.
Completely. Beijing's tactics didn't divide the democracies. They forged them into a much tighter, more capable, and more heavily armed alliance.
It is a remarkable geopolitical backfire. Yeah. Wow. We have covered incredible ground today in this deep dive. Let's synthesize what we've learned from these intelligence assessments.
Yeah.
We are witnessing a profound shift in the nature of global power. Asymmetric tactics, whether it's cheap drones taking out Russian ferries in the Black Sea, or Iranian Marvis and Houthi missiles creating massive economic choke points in the Red Sea, are allowing smaller actors to grind superpowers to a halt.
Which was unthinkable a decade ago.
Right. And at the same time, we're seeing how that grinding pressure exposes the internal fragility of autocratic regimes. Whether it's a policy vacuum caused by Iran's missing leader, or Xi Jinping's calculated use of corruption charges to purge his own hand-picked loyalists without looking weak, it shows that absolute power is incredibly difficult and deeply paranoid to maintain under pressure.
And it is vital to remember why this matters to you listening right now. This isn't just, you know, distant geopolitical theory playing out on a map in a war room.
No, it hits home.
It really does. The disruption of these maritime choke points, the destruction of vital ferries and commercial tankers, the forced rerouting of global energy supplies, this directly impacts global shipping insurance. It dictates the fuel prices at your local pump, and it fundamentally alters the cost of the goods you buy every single day.
Yeah, when the arteries of global trade are constricted, the whole world feels the lack of oxygen in their wallets.
Exactly. The global conveyor belt affects everyone.
Which leaves us with a final lingering question to ponder as we wrap up this exploration of the source material. We've seen how a nation without a traditional navy, like Ukraine, can single-handedly force a superpower to retreat from the Black Sea.
True.
And we've seen how non-state actors can paralyze global energy trade in the Red Sea using drones and missiles. So are massive multi-billion dollar traditional navies becoming obsolete, floating targets in an era of cheap, smart drones? It's something to think about the next time you see a heavily armored multi-billion dollar warship on the news.
A fascinating question that military planners around the world are definitely losing sleep over right now.
Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. We love unpacking these complex global shifts with you. Stay curious, and we will catch you next time.